Hey, thank you so much for joining with us on Other Things with Chris Clayton. And I'm so excited to have Chris on the show today. Chris and I go back to 2004. There's a long story behind that. We'll get into that a little bit because it tells a lot about the type of person that Chris is. But before we get into actually introducing him, you seeing his face, I want to tell you about Chris. He's a contemporary Christian music and worship leader, producer, songwriter based here in Nashville and Franklin, Tennessee. And I like this on his bio. If you go to chrisclayton.com, this bio is featured there. But I like it. He writes on his bio, a born and raised Texan. And so we're Texans too. So even though we're here in Tennessee, and we don't say that too loud because Tennesseans don't like it, but he's born and raised Texan. And he and his family moved here to Nashville in 2016 after signing his first publishing deal. He's been working and investing in artists and churches over 20 years. And the way I know Chris is because he was a personal mentor to my oldest son, Colton Price, who's also here in Nashville doing music. And so we're forever grateful to Chris. But in addition to his production and songwriting work, he served just recently for many years as the worship pastor for Gateway Church in Franklin, Tennessee, a dynamic church. And Chris stepped away from that. And we're going to talk a little bit about that on what God is doing in his life and these next steps. And he served in capacity as worship leader. And I want to just say up front that I've seen Chris in action in every way. My younger son, Joseph, was also mentored by Chris and traveled with Chris extensively as his drummer, the Chris Clayton Band. And so Chris was with, Joseph was with Chris in all settings. And Chris is the real deal. And it's encouraging to know someone who is the same in private as they are in person in public. And but Chris is credited on projects with a variety of artists, including Chris Tomlin, Keith and Kristen Getty. And I want to talk about them, Chris. A pretty powerful story there. Big Daddy Weave, Josh Baldwin with Bethel Music, Shane and Shane, which Shane and Shane is huge. And there's so a whole list of people. But he's written and or produced records for some of the largest churches in America, which worship is, you know, the core of Chris's heartbeat, including the Belonging Company, Houston's First Baptist Church, Valley Creek Church, Pine Lake Church, and Crossroads Church. And in addition, Chris was nominated as songwriter in 2018 for the Gospel Music Association of Canada Covenant Award for Pop Song of the Year. And we can even get into that because you have connections with a guy who's been very successful in Canada. But he resides here in Nashville. But anyway, a lot going on there, but that is Chris Clayton. But Chris, thank you so much for coming on Other Things With. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks, Kenny. Appreciate you having me. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, man, I tell you, let's get right into it. And, you know, I know you, and like I said, I've known you for, man, that's 20 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, Chris is an amazing guitar player. I think you call it, would you call it, something I think you're best at, that's my opinion, is colorizing. I mean, would you call it that?
You know? Yeah, that's I've never called it that, but I think that's a pretty accurate term. Yeah.
Yeah, because I met a guy that played for Tate. Tate came to Valley View Mall back in the day in Dallas, and his guitar player was sitting there, and he was a pro player from Nashville. And I said, you're amazing. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm a colorizer. That's what I do in the studio is I pump up the music. But in our past days, when we worshiped in church together at 121 Community Church, Chris was such an added feature to the band vocally and but in his guitar playing, to where he's just this maestro of all this layering going on in the background. But did you, I don't know anything about how you got into music personally.
Yeah. You know, music kind of runs in the family a little bit. Well, my dad's a pastor. You know, my dad pastored in Southern Baptist churches all over the Texas and Oklahoma. And my mom, but back up, my dad played drums in high school. And he actually still has his early 60s Rogers drum kit from high school, Silver Sparkle. One day I'm going to get that, Dad. So then mom played piano. And so music's kind of been in the family, maybe not on a career level, but definitely in the church side of things. And so I took on to it shortly after we moved to Beaumont, Texas, down in Southeast Texas. My dad was took on a pastorate down there. And thanks to my youth pastor growing up, and I'm sure many people can credit youth ministry years to like finding their way and finding their callings and bents. And I'm a product of that and began to discover guitar. And my grandparents bought me my very first guitar. And
What was that?
Gosh, I couldn't even tell you. It wasn't even a major brand. It was just, all I remember, Kenny, is that the action of the strings was like that far off the fretboard, which forced you to learn how to play the chords right. And I remember my youth pastor, Andy, giving me an opportunity to lead worship for the very first time in our youth group. And that was kind of what got me rolling. We would go to conferences and I would see these other worship leaders. And this is before, you know, conferences were conferences. This is like, you know, Dawson McAllister. I don't know if you remember Dawson McAllister. Oh, yeah. We used to go to Dawson McAllister conferences and I'd see a guy by the name of Joel Engel, who was part of my story later on the line, and Chris Tomlin Young, and a guy named Todd Proctor, who were leading worship. And we would buy CDs and I would take them back and learn every single song on that CD and lead it in our youth group. And that's kind of what got the bug initially. And the story goes from there. So.
Yeah, so because what's interesting is Chris is from Texas in Grand Saline, which was north of you. So he's a Texas boy, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then Joel Engel, amazing piano player, songwriter. Joel's doing some other things now. I kind of keep up with him through LinkedIn. But when you talk about that guitar, you know, Jack White, that a guitar he plays on the Seven Nation Army, it's like at Montgomery Ward's. What was it called? Airline was the brand.
Yeah.
So that maybe that's what it was.
I just remember it was just an acoustic guitar and it was a simple learning guitar, but it was the best thing I thought ever. You know, I didn't even think about brands and you just thought about, I have a guitar, so I get to start learning. So
now did you take lessons or are you self-taught?
I've self-taught. We bought a book with chords, and my mom can play piano by ear. She can sit down and play the hymnal by ear. And I think I got that bug and I could just hear a song. And as long as I could figure out the chords or where to put a capo, I would just learn songs that way. And I've never had any kind of formal training at all. It's just all been kind of by ear. So,
and you know, that's how it always was until in recent times. I remember Kurt Cobain was being interviewed after Nirvana hit big, and they were standing, I can still remember, they were standing on a balcony. And there was like water below. So they were somewhere, you know, high rise hotel, and the reporter, you know, and it's Novosek or Czech, however you say his name, and Grohl and Cobain, they're, you know, down this tiny balcony, the wind's blowing. The guy said, well, now that you're popular and, you know, you have money, do you think you'll go back and learn, take lessons? Mm. And Cobain's like, I think it's missing the point, you know, but that's awesome because I tell you, Chris is an amazing. So that's fundamental. Of course, he's a songwriter, producer as well now, but as a musician, he's amazing. So, kind of go forward. So you come home, you're learning how to lead worship. And let me say, interject here, that one of the reasons why, you know, my sons are the musicians they are, and Colton, the producer, songwriter that he is because of Chris's personal investment. And I remember the night that Colton was invited, Chris was leading the youth worship on Wednesday nights at the church, and they needed a drummer. So Colton went to audition, and I came back and he did the worship for the youth, but then a position came open in the main service, and he auditioned and he came back and they said, I'm not ready yet. And I'm like, you know, at first I was like, what? And they said, you know, you just don't have your groove yet. And, you know, you guys were right. And so he continued to practice. And I remember he auditioned and they came back and they said, you're ready. Mm-hmm. And so, I will be forever grateful. Yeah. But, you know, you had that example in your own life and then you've been that to other people. But tell me a little bit about that in your experience, because you've been that in shaping people your whole life. So give me a little bit of feedback on that.
I went to Dallas Baptist University out of high school up in the DFW area, which is where I met Kara, and we spent all 4 years, and then right after graduation we got married. And if I give you a little context, forever I thought I was going to move to Nashville right out of high school and go to Belmont University. That's kind of what the plan was, and then opted to go to DBU for a couple of years, and then I thought I'll go to DBU a couple of years, then I'll transfer to Belmont. and met Kara, changed everything on that end of things. But yeah, shortly after graduation, we got married, and I was like, I know what I want to do. I don't know how to do it. And so I just began to pray, God, would you bring someone in my life that could help me navigate the waters of production and songwriting, but also as a worship leader, because I really felt called to do both. Like, I felt called to lead worship in the church and also, you know, produce and resource other church leaders and worship leaders and artists. And God brought about a man by the name of David Parker into my life. And back in, this would be early 2002. And David and I just hit it off, and he kind of just invited me into his whole world, everything from his studio to traveling on the road with him and leading. That eventually led to going on staff with him at 121 Community Church there in the Dallas area, and really spent the next 4 to 5 years just kind of under him and just learning everything from the mechanics of producing records and engineering and songwriting to how to run and manage a itinerant worship ministry on the road. Everything. I still use things today, Kenny, that I've learned from David. Even in my latest, you know, working at Gateway, I almost thought every day of things I learned from David. And anyway, all that say, I served underneath him in the church, and then ended up kind of leaving him from a studio side, and started my own studio, and then production and traveling as well, leading worship. But and then, as it often does, God kind of reciprocates those things, and that brought me to Colton and Joseph. And man, it's just that Paul Timothy relationship that I just think we see modeled so well in the New Testament. And man, I often use that as an example. I think we've kind of lost that a little bit within the church and within society as a whole. And man, as much as that was, you say it was a gift to Colton and to Joseph and to you guys, it was a gift to me just to be able to run alongside them. And now seeing both of them just thriving in their families, most importantly, and also in their careers, it's been a treat.
Yeah. And I tell you, to have men involved in your kids' lives who are legitimate, who love the Lord, acted out, like I said, in private and in public, but then to take time to invest in them, because it does take time. And I think back in my own life, the men and women specifically who are the reason for me being here today and walking with Christ. And so just a tremendous opportunity. Let me ask you, in the work that you're doing, I noticed on... what's her name here? I got it written down. To Natalie Lane.
Mm, yeah.
Because amazing. I mean, she's got a ton of followers on Spotify. Mm-hmm. But you did some work with her recently. And I think, did you co-write a song? Did you produce it also? Or did you just?
Yeah. See, yeah. Natalie and I have met almost a couple of years ago now. We've written so many songs together, and she is just an amazing artist, amazing songwriter, amazing musician. She's got a master's degree in piano from Belmont, so if that tells you anything of her caliber, she's just, I remember the first time we wrote together, she sat down and just told her later, I was like, I did not expect that to come out of you today. Like, that was just a treat, just to write with her. And yeah, so we ended up, she put out an EP back in the summer of last year in 23, and wrote one of the songs on there and produced it as well with her. And then we're already in the trenches of working on some new stuff that's going to release later this year as well. So,
yeah. And I tell you, and I hope you take, I think it's a compliment, but some people may not like Sarah Bareilles, but, she reminds me of Sarah Bareilles. You know, I mean, not that she's copying her, but she has a strong voice. Mm-hmm. But then the fact that she has the piano skills that in concert, I imagine, you know, I imagine she would be amazing, because, you know, her title of her degree is, I've never even heard of this, but a master's in commercial piano. I mean, that's upper level piano stuff, but to have that kind of capability and then to be able to do that live would be amazing. But so I'm going to put some of these things in the show notes, because you can clock over, and I'll have the links for Chris's. He has a couple of Spotify channels, one on songwriting, but then also a Spotify channel for producing. So we'll make sure that that's in the hyperlinks. But anyway, so let's keep going here on your work with Keith and Kristen Getty. They have a huge amount of Spotify followers. And let me remind you folks that like in this type of algorithmic stuff, it's real individual followers. It's not, you know, the computers that are doing the generation, but you've done a lot of work with them. So give me a little bit of background on your work with Keith and Kristen Getty.
Yeah, man, that was a treat. Again, you know, one of the things I've learned is just since moving to Nashville is, you know, there are a lot of talented people and who work in this town, and you know that takes a that's a huge part of the quote unquote formula of success, if you will. But I think having authentic relationships is probably the most important thing in this town. And yeah, my relationship with Keith and Kristen came out of a relationship with another producer, a guy by the name of Nathan Knuckles, who's become a friend over the years. And we ended up having coffee one day and he said, hey, I'd love to give your name to the Getty's crew. And they're doing a new conference record, their new live record this year. And I've historically produced it in the past, but I'm not going to do this year. I think you do a great job at it. So was very honored, kind of humbled that they would ask, and they ended up contacting me. And yeah, we just wrapped it up right before the end of the year. And by the time this comes out, it will be out. It's a new live, it's called Sing. And it's a conference record they put out every year. So 18 songs on this record, and just some great modern hymns for the church. And just a lot of special guests like Chris Tomlin and City of Light from Australia, and Sandra McCracken, and a bunch of different artists along with them. So just really an honor to be a part of that record.
Oh, so now, because they're actually from Northern Ireland, and I was looking at their bio on Spotify, so they have a home in Northern Ireland and a home here in Nashville.
Yeah.
So now, did you do the live recording, or did you have engineers to do that, or how?
Yeah, so this is a very unique record. They did a world tour in 2023, and when you listen to the record, it's going to be tracks from all over the world. It's tracks from Belfast, Ireland, from Sydney, Australia, from Singapore, and then they do a worship conference every year here in Nashville, and that was back in September of last year. And we did a special pre-conference night at the Ryman, so we recorded live at the Ryman. And then we did I guess it was two or three days, full days of recording at Bridgestone Arena. And so that was the whole conference, and we captured so many songs, and then we just ended up picking kind of A&R-ing the record with them. So we brought in a whole team, a guy by the name of Danny Duncan and his team, who is an incredible engineer. He captured the record, but I was on site just, you know, soaking it all up with all these amazing musicians and kind of helped steer the ship with Danny.
Wow. Now, so I did not know this about you, Chris. So you're talking the Ryman, the true mother church of country music. So y'all actually, so you were in the room live recording there and at Bridgestone. So that's a big deal. But as a side note, you know, I went to take a tour of Ryman. I was here for a conference at First Baptist Church Hendersonville. And so I thought, well, I'm here, I've got to go to the Ryman. So they were getting ready for, and I've told this story before, but they were getting ready for a gospel music night, and all the big names were going to be there. So I went up into the balcony because they had this big Yamaha, you know, like the PMD-1 or whatever it's called. So anyway, that's awesome. So now, I guess, is the console recording always upstairs in the balcony, or where did y'all position?
Yeah, from? You know, so, yeah, so I wasn't, you know, it's in, you know, as far as like the Ryman, we actually just, there's not a lot of room backstage in the Ryman. If you've ever taken a tour, it's, you know, just a few handful, there's multiple levels of dressing rooms and whatever, but we were right off the side of the stage. Everything is so, you know, digital, and we basically just took a split off with a Cat 5 cable basically into Danny's rig and captured it on a couple of different laptops, one primary laptop and one redundant laptop in case the primary one went down. And so we were just on a little side room, little dressing room at Ryman. And then at Bridgestone, we were actually in the Predators locker room for it. So we were back kind of way backstage. We were with the broadcast, because they live stream the conference. You can live stream the conference if you can't attend in person. And so we had a video feed, and then we just, again, Danny just had a couple of laptops and a couple Cat 5 cables. And we captured over, I think somewhere close to 200 tracks at the conference, you know, all at once. Now, not every track was used for every song, but, you know, there was a lot of information going on. I think I walked away with close to 4 or 5 terabytes of information that after that conference.
Now, am I understanding correctly? Because I didn't know this, but did they wrote the song with one other guy in Christ Alone?
Yeah. So Keith wrote the song with Stuart Townend in Christ Alone. And yeah, that's actually on the new record. They did, we did a kind of a reimagined version with City of Light, who's a worship band from Australia. And so, yeah, but that him and Keith wrote that.
Yeah. Which, I mean, if anybody sings, if you go to church and you sing in worship, you've sung the song in Christ Alone, but they were singing it. I thought, well, are they doing a cover? And then I looked it up and he actually wrote it along with the person that Chris mentioned. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be awesome. And that should be, well, actually I listened to it online. So it's out there on Spotify, but that's awesome. It's exciting, isn't it, to see those types of things happen?
Yeah, for sure. Just surreal moment to be able to stand in places like Ryman and, you know, and get tracks from the Sydney Opera House where they did the Sydney stop and all these others, you know, that came in, and just know those places were transformed into places of worship, you know, that, and just to capture those moments was honoring.
No, that's cool. So if you don't mind me asking, who did the final mix on this?
Yeah. A guy by the name of Warren David. Warren is, to give you context, I met Warren. Warren used to be Sean Moffitt's assistant back in the day. And so Sean, you know, was a real big catalyst to me getting here to town. And so I met Warren through Sean years ago. And Warren's mixed a lot of stuff, and he's mixed a lot of the other Getty stuff as well. So we just kept him on the team. So
that's cool. So tell me about Katie Reynolds. That's an interesting story. When I saw, you know, kind of her background, and it looks like you've had some influence in her life, you know, as far as I think production. Mm-hmm. But if you want to share anything about that, I think it's kind of a cool story.
Yeah. You know how you said Texans kind of stick together? Well, she's a Texan as well. And it was kind of in the Dallas area in Central Texas. And we met here in Nashville, met through a mutual friends at a songwriting round that she was opening up for one night. This is a couple years ago. And I was just blown away by her voice and her talent and just her bent on music, just kind of coming at it in a fresh way, you know, very kind of soulful pop style. And so we just kind of hit it off, and I said, hey, let's write. So we wrote a couple times, and then, man, I just felt like I was just supposed to kind of help develop her a little bit and just pour into her, and just loved her heart, loved where she's at. And she was just one of those at that stage in her career where she's like, I've got songs, I've got vision, I need help with some execution of this. And so we've been working together. Gosh, I think we did 3 or 4 songs last year, about to start a new one here in 2024. And yeah, I'm proud of her. I'm proud of the music we've done, that we put out. It's just, you know, just, it's just fun to pour into someone who has got some great talent and to see kind of their platform to do ministry and just elevate and reach more people and see just her grow in so many areas. So that's been fun to watch with Katie.
Now, I thought I saw a picture. I can't find it, but with Darlene, is it Zesh?
Check.
How do you say
check,
that?
Check. Like write a check.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know. But yep. Now, have you been doing some work with her? Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I got a call. She's doing a record where she's kind of redoing some of her really just impactful worship songs, including Shout to the Lord, which we all know Darlene from Shout to the writer and kind of main worship leader for Shout to the Lord. And she's doing kind of a reimagined album of some of her, you know, more impactful, bigger worship songs. And so she was in the States in Nashville, and her and her husband Mark are a part of, they helped start a church years ago called Hope Unlimited Church. And there's a campus here in the Thompson Station, Spring Hill area of Nashville. And my buddy Dustin Smith, who's the pastor out there, called me and said, hey, we need someone to help produce some gang vocals and some choir vocals for Darlene's record. Would you want to come do that? And so I said, absolutely. And so we gathered a bunch of people and spent 2 nights, one week back in the fall, just singing some amazing songs that we, you know, just songs that we grew up on, just but in a really fresh way. So she was a treat. She's the real deal. It was a joy to work with her.
Well, and those watching may not know, but she was the worship leader for years and years with Hillsong, wasn't she?
Yeah, with Hillsong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big deal, but I'm excited for you about that. But as we talk about music and influence, and you know, I think about you as a singer-songwriter, which you don't really promote that, but there's a lot of albums that are on, I get YouTube Music, and all of your albums that you've done in the past are, I say, all, I don't know that all of them are, I don't know all that you put out, but I would encourage people to go to Spotify. The bad part about Spotify is if you're not paying for it, you can't go in and select the track, but the albums are also on YouTube Music, and that's free to everybody. So I think about a song, and I tell you, I still think, and I've encouraged Chris with this, and I'm just one person, but I want to share the type of impact of Chris's songwriting, because let me ask you first to make sure. I think, are you the sole songwriter? This was off of your album, Jesus, I Love You. It was on, I've got it written down here. It was out in 2011, Hope of Glory. Mm-hmm. But were you the sole songwriter on that, or was there anybody else?
I believe I wrote that with a guy in Dallas. Well, it's a guy I grew up with in Beaumont. His name's Justin Brooks. I believe that's who I wrote that one with. It's been forever. But yeah, we wrote that, gosh, forever ago. And yeah, we played the mess out of that song, all sorts of events. And it's just a big song. So yeah.
Well, and I tell you, and I'm just one person, but I do know music. You know, I'm musically trained, and my kids are partly in music because of that. But the song Jesus, I Love You, I still, at some point, someone is going to hear this song, and they're going to say, we got to record that. And I know one of the struggles here in Nashville, and there was a great article written about this probably a year ago about one of the guys in the industry is saying, you know, folks, we need to loosen up and start recording outside cuts. And I believe, and for those of you who don't know what that means, in other words, an artist that didn't write the song, but they record someone else's song and include it on their album. Now, that means they don't get the royalties from the songwriting payout, but they do get the artist. And the bigger thing is if you have a number one hit with it, it really doesn't matter who wrote it. You're going to be filling seats, and you're going to be selling merchandise, and you're going to be successful both being airplay and financially. And anyway, the song Jesus, I Love You, to me, Chris, I think is one of the best songs you've ever written. And the litmus test for it, because like I said, my oldest son, songwriter, producer, he said, Dad, the litmus test is, you know, I think they call it the child test, that like if a child listens to it and then they're singing it, you know, you've got a hit on your hands, because
yeah,
the way a child. And so my wife at the time was working as a preschool teacher at our elementary school, where actually she and I went to school, you know, when we were kids. And so she had Chris's CD playing on the boombox in the room a lot, you know, during their work time. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, she came home just in tears when she said that they were on the playground, you know, they had the break time, and that one of the kids was a little boy. She's still over here. She's tearing up. But this little boy running across the playground singing, I love you, Jesus, wow. I love you. And she's like, wow, you know, wow. Before my words get lost in song, yeah. my heart desires and longs to say to say that I love you.
Yeah.
And I tell you, you know, I think, you know what I envision, and I'm just one guy, but here's what I'm praying. That song is made for Natalie Grant. It's just made for her. And with her passion and her soul. So anyway,
wow.
What do you say about
that? Yeah, well, I did not know that story about that. And that's pretty humbling. And I'm grateful you told me that. I'll tell you another story that was even more crazy with that particular song. Kara and I, my wife, we went to Cambodia back in 2012. I believe it was on a mission trip with our church, with 121. And we had a family over there who was serving as kind of missionaries, a guy named Alf Evans. I don't know if you remember Alf or not. And, Alf and his wife and family were serving over there. And Alf, you know, Alf is a worship leader and plays guitar. And, you know, it's just a crazy guy. I love that guy. And, he said, hey, he called me up. We went to this loft at the top of this place we were doing ministry that day. And, It was a recovery area for our home for girls who had been trafficked, human trafficked, and they would come out of that, and this was a place for them to heal and learn a skill and all that stuff. And so part of that was through a Christian lens and through gospel, lens. And so Alf did worship every day for these girls, and he would do that song, Jesus, I Love You. And they taught him how to lead it in Khmer, their native language. And so when we were there, he said, come here, I want to show you something. And he gathered all these girls around, and they started singing that chorus, Jesus, I love you, in Khmer. And you talk about losing it. I lost it. And then I quickly grabbed my phone and I recorded that. Still to this day have it on my phone of them singing the song, chorus, that was crafted probably in a bedroom somewhere on the other side of the world in another language. And the first time that ever happened was that. And that was pretty surreal.
Now, that's awesome. But it speaks to the power of music. It speaks to the power of music to heal and transform. And this song, I mean, is pure gospel, but it's done in such a way to where it's the full proclamation. And I think about a guy named T. Ray Grandstaff. And T. Ray, I was a youth pastor in Greenwood, Arkansas. He was already out of the youth group and was going to Brown University playing football, but a dynamic guy. He's now, he's been with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes forever. He was the state director for Arkansas. I don't know if he's moved up or, but anyway, he, in closing prayer, because he was going back to school, and I went over to his house to see him. And we're standing out. His parents had a tennis court in Greenwood, Arkansas, which was elite. But he was said, well, Kenny, he said, before we go, can I pray with you? And I said, sure. And he said, well, can we hold hands? And I thought, well, this is awkward. I'm out on a tennis court, and it's out, on the street. And it's like, okay. Well, but at the end, he said, Jesus, I just want to tell you, I love you. And, that I'm so, and it made me feel uncomfortable. It's the first time I'd ever heard a man tell Jesus that they loved him. And it transformed my life, and being able to tell Jesus personally, openly in prayer, that I love him. So I think it's a dynamic song. And is there any memory you have about, and I know you've written a bunch of songs, but in that one particular, that where did that come from? Did it just, in your soul welling up, or what?
Gosh, I don't even remember where it came from. I remember the first time we led it as a band. We were doing a See You at the Pole rally in Burleson, Texas. And for those that may not be familiar with that, every See You at the Pole was a big student gathering around literally the flagpole every morning. It's one morning in September every year. And traditionally, the churches would just do rallies and, big worship nights and outreach nights. And we would do a lot of those. And we were kind of beginning to test some of the songs for that Hope of Glory record. And because my band played on the record, and we would write all the parts. And I said, hey, let's try this. And we literally just played it. And I remember that the student pastor who put it on that night, he said, if you don't do that song, you're going to miss a big deal. It's going to be a big miss tonight. And somehow we squeaked it out, even though we had never played it together. And it kind of became this mainstay as part of that record. So
it's awesome. I'm going to have a link to that song in particular, which will also get you to Chris Clayton, his personal music, his own recordings as a recording artist. But it'll also give you, I won't take time to play it now, but I tell you, you will want to check that out after listening or watching this program. And by the way, let me say that this program is available on YouTube, but also we upload it as an audio podcast on our monologue audio website for Quad.Rocks, God, the World, and other things. So this will be available also just in audio only. So if you're traveling on a trip or on your way to work, so check that out. But I want to ask you a little bit about your family. I tell you, I think a testimony of God's faithfulness and what Chris has modeled to me, my family, is he's got 5 children and a wife. And so that makes 7 people. And Chris was very successful in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and doing quite well from there, but made the decision, as I said, back in, I guess it was 16, to move here. And, you had 4 children then, and then adopted Cambry. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, but it was a big deal. And so share with me your journey, because as a man with responsibility, for a wife and 4 kids, you've got a beautiful wife, Kara, who's been dynamic. I mean, she was involved in everything at the church. She served personally, which folks, if you don't come from a ministry background, a lot of pastors' wives don't. I'm just telling you, that's the truth. But Kara has been intimately involved in Chris's ministry and her own ministry. But so tell me about that. When you made that commitment to pack up, sell your home, come here. I mean, tell me a little bit about that spiritual journey for you and your family.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was, moving to Nashville was, like I said earlier, it was a dream of college, Chris. And I feel like the Lord said, it's not a no, but it's a not right now type answer. And fast forward to, 2015, and we'd been doing itinerant ministry on the road, leading worship, production and writing there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I had signed my first publishing deal with a guy by the name of Michael Farron and with Integrity Music. It was kind of a joint venture with them. And I wrestled because I was like, I think we're supposed to move to Nashville, but who moves to Nashville at age 38 with four kids? You know, it was just one of those things of like, that sounds very irresponsible at the time. The more we kept praying about it and thinking about it, the more I felt like the Lord just kept affirming it. And we'd spend the rest of the podcast talking about that whole journey. But it was just affirmation after affirmation after affirmation that we were supposed to go. But probably the one I remember the most was I walked in one day in April of 2016 to our kitchen. My studio was at our house at the time. And I was just frustrated. I just felt like nothing was going right. But yet a lot of things were going right in Nashville, but for whatever reason, things weren't going right in Texas. And I walked in, Kara was at the kitchen sink, and I just stopped her and I said, I think we're supposed to move to Nashville. And she just started bawling. And I was like, nope, we're not supposed to move to Nashville. And he said, I've been waiting for you to come tell me that for a good couple of months, because the Lord told me we were supposed to move to Nashville, but I wanted to honor your leadership and have him tell you first. And then we would pray over it. And I said, well, I think we're supposed to move to Nashville. And so we made that decision. And, you know, we moved in October of 2016. We put our house in the market in September. It sold within 24 hours. This is before the hot market of what we're used to having. Sold over asking price, you know, almost sight unseen. Just one of those God things. It was God just, and then we didn't have a house in Nashville. So we had to quickly buy a house in Nashville. And you know, we started a whole journey here, but I tell you the cool thing, Kenny, about moving here and what God's been showing me lately is that, while we moved here for what I was doing in terms of music and ministry, it's been fun to watch what the Lord is doing in my family as a result of moving here. You mentioned Cambry, you know, we moved to Nashville with four boys. Now he's 20, he was 13 at the time, you know, 20 down to 15 now. And then we adopted Cambry, you know, from right here in Nashville, and she's from Franklin. And crazy story I can get into if you want to, but that's just another God kind of wink. And I was just saying, hey, that's why I also brought you. And then just to see my boys find their bents, you know, and what they do, you know, in their careers. I mean, my oldest is in lighting and on the road touring, and he wouldn't have found that necessarily without moving to Nashville. So it's just been cool to see just kind of God just fingerprinting and kind of leading us individually, also collectively.
Yeah. So you have one, I guess they all play ball, but then you have one that, what's the broken bone count? I mean, I follow you guys on Facebook and Kara, I mean, you know, the stress, you know, because let me say, Chris is a man's man and all four of his kids are men's men. I mean, they're rugged. They're going at it, you know, 100 miles an hour. So, but don't you have one? I mean, it's totally off the subject, but I just think about it because of Kara's reports on Facebook that we're at the ER. And which one is it? One in particular?
I think it's Callan. Probably has the most punches in the frequent ER card. My second oldest. He's our kid that is not fearful of anything, which I love. It comes with a lot of stress because I'm not that way. I'm more the reserved guy. But we have two that are, you know, full bore at what they do. And it's, yeah, I'm waiting for the ER bill to be a buy one, get one free at some point, but I don't think that's coming.
Get your discount. now your oldest son, Corbin, I guess you had connections because you worked with Big Daddy Wee. So was that the first group? Did you have somehow a connection to give him some exposure to that? Because now he's doing it as a career, but he got his first taste of working on the road with Big Daddy Weave. Is that right? Am I remembering correctly?
That is right. And, you know, I have been kind of borderline obsessed with stories of watching the Lord go before us and do what he does in that. And you mentioned I worked on a Big Daddy Weave record. That was probably 04, 05 when I was still with David. And they came through Soundtown there in the Dallas area, and we got to work on the record a little bit. And through that, I met their guitar player, Jeremy Redman, Big Daddy's guitar player. And really, you know, we didn't spend a whole lot. We spent a lot of time together, but not in a lengthy amount of time. But we, you know, through social media, we've kept up with each other. And then one day, Jeremy and his family showed up at Gateway about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and we reconnected. Everybody remembered each other, and through that, I introduced Corbin to him and said, "Hey, you know, if you ever hear of anything, you know, he's looking." Turns out they were hiring an intern, a paid internship, to go out on the road and kind of just be a general tech. And so through that, he went out on a weekend just to kind of test it out. And then next thing you know, he was hired for their spring tour like a year ago. And out of that, he's kind of morphed into the full-time lighting director for another band called We Are Messengers. And he's out on the road with them full-time, and leaving literally in about a month to go do another tour. He did their tour. They just wrapped up doing like 40 cities, and they're about to go do 20 plus, and then other things. So
what's the story there? So he's the lighting director for We Are Messengers, which is a very successful, Watts over here saying yes. Mm-hmm. But, so how did that transpire?
Yeah. So, he had a good friend who was We Are Messengers lighting director. That it's just that community, just like there's musicians, there's a whole community of crew guys that know each other, and especially in the Christian music world. And he had a friend that was their LD guy, and he ended up leaving, and so that kind of had an opening. And so his friend needed a fill-in on a weekend. They were planning to show up in Connecticut, and he couldn't make it. So we called Corbin. It's like, "Hey, if you're home, could you come and fill in for me for We Are Messengers?" Corbin went and did the event. If I'm honest with you, Kenny, it went horrible. Like the gear was not working right. Corbin thought he botched the gig. He thought they're never going to call me. It wasn't his fault. It was just stuff out of his control, but it was in his world. And it wasn't probably, I don't know, less than a few months later that he got a call from We Are Messengers management saying, "Hey, we have an opening and Darren would love for you to be a part of the team." And he's like, "Absolutely." And as they say, the rest is history. And he's been with them, I guess, a good 6 months now, and did all the summer festival dates and then did the fall tour. And like I said, they're about to go out on the spring tour. And I think there's rumors of even Europe sometime later this year. So...
Oh man, mom's going to be worrying now, but
yeah.
well, that's a praise the Lord, man. That's just an affirmation about God's hand on his life and, you know, the things that he's interested in, and it's happening. Man, that's exciting. But tell me a little bit, you know, let's share with our viewing audience about Cambry, a little bit your journey there, and encouragement. I tell you, you know, from all the stuff that is posted to Facebook with mom and the kids, very quickly Cambry became the sibling leader. Because though she may be the smallest and the youngest, I have a feeling that she dominates. So share a little bit with people about your journey and adoption and your love for Cambry.
Yeah, you are spot on, Kenny. She has become that person in a really fun way. Tara and I had always, when we were dating in college at DBU, when we started getting serious, you know, one of the things that came up in conversation was both of our desires to adopt. You know, that's that's been huge in my heart from a long time, and it was huge on her heart. And when we started talking, it was like, okay, this is unique, and let's see what the Lord has. We thought forever, even after getting married, that we would adopt internationally. And we quickly found out, back through my youth pastor growing up in Beaumont, really opened our eyes to just this. There's so many kids in our own backyard domestically here, you know, wherever you live, that have a broken situation and need a home. And he adopted his daughter. And so that really kind of opened our eyes, and we're like, okay, maybe that's what the Lord has for us. And we're also a real big, I'm a huge fan of Steve and Curtis Chapman, and I've loved watching their journey with their kids, and, you know, even their ministry show Hope. And all that to say, when we were living in Texas, we even had a house and an extra bedroom we would call the sister's room, that was just prepared for her, that one day that we have no idea when and how and where she's going to come from, or he's going to come from. We didn't know it was going to be a girl. We just, whoever they come from, that this is going to be their room. So we started the foster to adopt, or fostering training in Texas. We didn't get very far before we moved to Nashville. That training doesn't cross Texas, you know, to state lines. And so we thought, well, we'll have to start over. Let's pray through that. And fast forward to right before the summer of 18. And we felt, okay, we've been here long enough. We've established some residency, some rhythm. Let's look into this fostering idea and see if that maybe is what the Lord's going to use to lead us to adoption. And so we were about to start the journey in that. And one day, back in June of 18, I got a, we had a kind of get together with some friends over at some other friend's house, and just a kind of a pool party cookout thing, no agenda, just hang out. And we got to spend some time with an older couple that was at Gateway. And we shared our story, this very story I just shared with you, just kind of our desire to adopt. And they really thought that was special, unique, that God had something for us, prayed over us, encouraged us. And that was on a Saturday. Fast forward to a Monday, and I get a phone call from that gentleman, from the guy that we were talking to out of the couple. And he said, hey, crazy enough, I just got a phone call from some friends of ours, and said that their daughter just gave birth to a little baby girl here in Franklin. They didn't know she was pregnant, and they can't keep the baby. And so immediately the Lord put you on our mind, and didn't know maybe if you wanted to adopt this baby. And I tell you, Kenny, I stood at my studio, and I don't remember anything of the conversation other than saying, I think I need to talk to my wife about this. And I hung up the phone, and I realized they're on their way to come get me. We were going to the Ryman that night to go see a show. And I was like, okay, they're coming to get me. Do I tell them, do I tell Kara the boys now, or do I tell them after we get home? And I said, I don't really want to distract the night. So I'm going to tell them when we get home. So we did the show, that we went to the show, which I remember nothing of, because all I can think of is my potential future daughter is lying in a little hospital bed just down the road in Nashville from the venue. And we go to the show, we get home. By the time everybody's settled in bed, it's close to 1 a.m. and I'm brushing my teeth. Kara's in bed, and I go, hey, before you go to bed, I need to talk to you about something. And she's like, well, can we talk about it in the morning? I'm like, nope, we sure can't. And I told her the story, and of course she just loses it, and her first words were, that's our daughter. And she just knew. And we began the process, and she was born on that Sunday, on Father's Day of 16. And by that Friday of that following week, we brought her home from the hospital.
That's amazing, because I mean, that's been, how many years ago is that? Eight?
Yeah, five. She's 5 years. She's five and a half now.
Wow. I mean, she looks older than five.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. And I tell you, you know, I have to make the tie in that as Christians, you know, every one of us are adopted into God's family. And so adoption is a part of who we are. Mm-hmm. And when someone, I'm just enamored at what Chris and Kara did, and the fact they already had four children, you know, working as a worship pastor, a producer, songwriter, and all of that. And then, you know, hearing, I didn't know that, Chris, that this has been a longing in y'all's heart for a long time. That's Texan talk. We say y'all and ball. Balling means to cry your eyes out. I don't, you know, but, you know, it's an encouraging story. And I tell you, Chris, as you were sharing the story about your son and then about Cambry, and this kind of happens really, it's almost every YouTube show we do, all of a sudden at a point, it's just, I feel the Lord. It's like kind of a warmth and it's a sensation. It's real, the presence of the Lord. And, you know, I see this reoccurring theme in your life that's manifested in both people that poured into you and then you pouring into my kids, but then pouring into your own kids. And then now they're going and doing likewise. And then your adoption of Cambry, and you're pouring into her and giving her a different life, a life that where she knows Jesus and, you know, her needs are met and she's loved and wanted. So, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's almost like I'm watching you in your room and it's sort of just this, like the presence. I mean, God's with us always, but something is happening there to where, I celebrate that in your life.
You know, you mentioned adoption, you know, and how that parallels with the gospel. And that was the first thing that Kara and I just were excited about, that one day when we get to tell her, when she gets to fully understand her adoption story, that we get to parallel that with prayerfully her time that she comes to know Jesus, and how that's, we all been adopted. She's been adopted twice now. You know, it's just one of those things. And I'll tell you this, Ken, I just thought about this. The first picture I ever saw Cambry was emailed to me from her birth grandfather. And Colton was in the room when I opened that email, and was there when I saw the very first picture of Cambry.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just remembered that. Yeah,
that's awesome. So, do y'all have a working relationship with her biological parents, or what's it?
Yeah, it's a really cool situation. Her Cambry's birth grandparents went to go to Gateway. And the grandfather has since passed away, but the birth grandmother is still there. And so we would see her every week. And, you know, I say this in a loving, kind way, they don't want to have anything to do with that, with her, in terms of just her interaction. They're excited and just blessing us with her, and obviously, and just what we, as her parents now, but they just love loving on her from afar. And it's just been a great relationship.
Sure. And I think that's sometimes wise, but just the fact to know that they know where the child is and that she's being well cared for and loved, that's huge. Yeah. But, you know, we kind of got heavy there, which is good. I think it's something that can encourage all, because in these crazy times we're living in, and Chris and I both have a context of, you know, these are crazier than normal. But we need to hear the message of God's faithfulness and a man of strength like Chris, who's done hard things in following the Lord, and God has provided and blessed him every step of the way. And it says to all of us, we can look at Chris's life and say, hey, you know, if there's something that you're hesitating on moving forward in, especially in these times of uncertainty, you need to look at people like Chris. And I have the privilege of being able to say, I've known this guy a long time, and to say, you know, it works, it's legitimate. And you can move forward in hope. You can take those risks. You can take that jump at 38 to pack up your family and, you know, move to Beverly. And so I just want to encourage you, because, you know, these are challenging times, and people getting gridlocked in fear. And, you know, perfect love casts out all fear. And we've been loved perfectly by Jesus Christ. So on another note, just I'm curious, who were your musical influences when you were growing up? Who impacted you stylistically or emotionally?
Yeah. Oh man, it kind of runs some multi-genres. And I know you'll appreciate this, so I'll kind of give you a little bit of a scope. I grew up on Southern gospel a lot. My parents played it in the car, and so I kind of joked that I learned harmony by the Cathedral Quartet and all those guys. You know what I mean? Just kind of, I feel like that's kind of how I got my vocal chops and understanding that. I had a stint where I loved listening to 50s and 60s music, and growing up, and I feel like even that was like foundational, even though I didn't even know it, it was very foundational to just music. And But I would say influential early on. I mentioned him earlier. Stephen Curtis was an influence. Kind of one of those bucket list guys of people I'd love to work with one day, write with, even just go to dinner with, you know, type thing. Just love his heart, love his ministry, love his sincerity. I've heard, you know, I've had the privilege of meeting him a couple times, and it's just been a joy to meet. So for sure him. You know, Toby from DC Talk has been a big influence as a producer, as a writer, as someone who is constantly evolving and reimagining himself. That's always been a big influence. I would say those probably are the biggest two individuals that I just, you know, I've had a longevity and love watching their careers and still see love them do it and just have played into me doing what I do.
You know, we met a girl that there was a house for sale here where I live, and it's one of these homes built like 100 years ago. I just thought, I wonder what it looks like inside. And so the real estate agent, she married to Jason. She's married to Jason Patillo. She was Toby Mack's nanny for a time. Okay. And so this was after Truett tragically died. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, it's interesting, you know, her take on things, and she was willing to talk. And I said, you know, I know someone who worked with Toby closely, a guy named Gary Osher. I know you know Vicky Osher from 121. Was, you know, that was her husband. They were divorced. I don't know where they are now, but anyway. But he worked with Toby back in the day, and is friends with Toby. And he was telling me all these people that are just, you know, not legitimate. I'm just like, because I was talking to Gary about his salvation, and he was willing to meet me for coffee one day because he was very sick at the time. But anyway, but then he mentions Toby Mack, and I thought, oh, don't tell me Toby's not legitimate. You know, man, I mean, you know, diverse city. And he said, Toby Mack, and Gary was kind of cynical about the whole Christian industry because, of, you know, one time he was the largest placement of acts and venues in the United States. So anyway, but he said, yeah, Toby is the real deal. And it shows through. And even then, the way he handled his son's passing, they've been very transparent about it. But then this girl who worked for them, you know, and she doesn't have any, you know, skin in the game, so to speak. And then she said, they're legitimate, you know. So it's encouraging just that going on. And I tell you, from what we've seen here in Nashville, it's very encouraging because you hear so many war stories about entertainment industry, music industry. But wouldn't you say, or let me say, let me not put words in your mouth, but has it been your experience to see that most of the people in the Christian industry, you know, for specifically that you've met, that do you sense they are the real deal? I sense that from.
Yeah. Resounding yes. I've always said, cause people have asked me, you know, do you feel the competition in Nashville for what you do? And I say, well, I mean, there's competition, yes, but, it's not a cutthroat type of thing. We're all in this together. There's enough music to be made in this town. Trust me, you know, there's a lot of music that's coming out of this town. You know, many songs are being written in this town and released. I feel more community than competition. I feel like they're, the people that I do life with on a music side are championing each other. We champion each other. We want to help each other, even from encouragement and words to, hey, I need to borrow a microphone because mine just busted. Can I borrow yours? And, you know, they say, absolutely, come get whatever you want. And, you know, I think the litmus test to this is the ones that have been doing it for a long, long time are the ones that are most authentic, because this town can sniff out in a heartbeat people who are not authentic and who are you know, disingenuous about what they're doing. They don't last long. And that's not just from an artist side of things. That's from a session player, from a producer, from a songwriter. The ones that have longevity are the ones that have great families, who love their family, who love Jesus, who are involved in the church, who, you know, music is not their identity. It's their calling. And so when you see someone who's been doing it a long time, know that there's a reason the hand of God's on them, and that God's blessing them for a reason.
Amen. Well, before we close out, being that we're both Texans, I was actually born in Texas too. By the way, this is totally off. This is on the subject, but Beaumont, home of Mark Chestnut.
Yep.
Did you ever see him at the Stop and Go?
No, but I literally live down the street from Mark Chestnut.
Oh man. Now, a lot of people watching this are not going to have a clue as to who Mark Chestnut is. He was a country artist, very successful. And the thing I admired about Mark Chestnut, from what I can tell, because I followed him, because he was very successful and I liked his style. He wrote the song Bobby Shot the Jukebox Last Night, you know, played a love song and made him cry, you know, pulled out his gun and shot it with a 45. But he never left Beaumont. He didn't move to Nashville. He didn't go to L.A. He didn't go to New York. And so anyway, but how funny that. So you lived down the street from Mark Chestnut.
Yeah, I 5 minutes and I could have been to his house. Yeah.
Man, that needs to be on your resume. you know, I live down, I don't know what he's doing, but you know, talking to Colton about it, I think sometimes, you know, people, you know, they become successful financially. It frees them up to do other things. And like you said, you know, music is their calling. It's their ministry. If you're Christian and you're in the Christian industry, but people also have other interests. So I respect that. But how funny. I just, because as when you told me that you're from Beaumont, I'm going, wait, there's a famous musician from Beaumont. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could get snide and say, does it, you know, like they said about Jesus, does anything good come out of Beaumont? Because it's a coastal town. It's a coastal town, right?
Yeah. And ironically enough, George Jones came out of that area, Janis Joplin, and then ZZ Top.
Well, that's right. ZZ Top did come out of, the joke about Beaumont though, is just growing up in Texas, you know, Beaumont was, like I said, it's, any water town's always a little bit rougher, kind of industrial because of all the refineries and stuff down there. But, well, that's awesome. But so as we close out, I remember when you got your first, did you get a Traeger, a grill?
Yeah.
And so I got to ask you, because, you know, Will Denton was on the program and, you know, Will, knows David Parker. And when he told the story on the program that every time he'd go into Dallas, Fort Worth, he went back to the sandwich shop that David took him to. Anyway, so Will's gotten into smoking. So how is that going for you, my friend?
First of all, I remember that sandwich shop. It was called the sandwich was called the Sopranos Hero. We all got it. NYPD Deli, Euless, Texas. I can tell you exactly where it's at.
Well, wait. Okay, stop right there. Stop. So were you around then? I mean,
yes. Okay, yes.
Just pause for the talking about your smoking.
Yeah.
So now, were you still on staff at 121 then?
This is pre-121. This is pre-121 for both David and I. This is probably, David went on staff at 07, I believe. So this has been 05, 06. And yeah. And then even afterwards, we would bring it. No, this is before David was on staff. We were at First Euless for a while in the studio. And even after we moved to the Hearst location, Hearst, Texas location, we still bring in Brent, Will and Stephen Lawicki and all these other Nashville guys. That's a whole nother connection to even helping me move here, you know, just knowing those guys. So,
well, okay. So I remember Soundtown, because then David moved out of First Baptist Church Euless and then over into Bedford and had a studio upstairs, because Colton, you know, when he first started, David still had the space. So, but then what was y'all's connection to guys like Will Denton? I mean, how did that even, you know, how did they find you or whatever?
Yeah. So, we moved out of First Euless. We actually moved to Hearst. There was a location in Hearst and we had two-story studio, a B room upstairs. David's room was downstairs. Joel Engel was the connection, to these Nashville guys. So a guy by the name of Stephen Lawicki, who's still a producer and songwriter, and guitar player here in town, connected with Joel, and through that Joel said, hey, I want to use some Nashville guys on my next record. He'd used all Texas guys or a couple guys from Oklahoma and would come in and play. He wanted a different feel and different sound, so he hooked up with Steven, and then through that he's like, hey, I've got this guy named Will Denton. I knew who Will Denton was from the DC Talk of Stephen Curtis days. Obviously I was a fanboy, and so I was like, the Will Denton's coming. And then he brought another guy to come and play bass, you know, from Nashville. And so in that, David just loved the synergy that we had. And so we'd bring him in for records that made sense budget-wise. We'd bring him in, and they'd come and play on records. They played on some, like a Billy Foot record or a couple Billy Foot records. He's a, you know, Texas worship guy for a while. And gosh, we used them a lot. And so through that, yeah, we just kind of became friends. And I talked to Will the other day, not too long ago. We shot texts to each other. So
I tell you, folks, that again, back in the day, they used to do a game on the college campus called 7 Degrees of Separation from Kevin Bacon. And the more, even in just the few shows we've done, it's interesting how all these people are connected to where Chris Clayton and David Parker have a recording studio. The irony is that I was on staff at First Baptist Church Euless here a few years ago, and we had a space. It was room 131 on the downstairs floor of 450,000 square feet of space. And I went in and I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. And somebody told me, well, this used to be a recording studio. A guy named David Parker had sound talent here. And I said, this is where David started. So he was in the church and they were letting him use the space. But it's funny, Chris, because where the recording booth was at the, you know, when you entered, we left that intact and we turned that into a snack bar. And I used that as a conference room. We blacked, the ceiling was blacked out. We didn't, you know, enclose the ceiling, and we had cafe tables, and it became the favorite room. And so when I left that staff position there, they cannibalized, but everybody wanted that space. Wow. But to know that you guys were there, and yeah, it was in Hearst. It was on Pipeline Road, Soundtown. I think the location, the 2-story building. Mm-hmm. So a small world. And then Will Denton, and that is crazy.
Well, I'll share this real quick. We did some really significant records in that Euless, First Baptist Euless spot. We did the first Shane and Shane record there. Psalms was recorded there.
Wait right there. Now, how do you know? How were you connecting with Shane and Shane back then?
Well, you know, David, at the time, you know, it was a different time. You know, this was like the early 2000s, and David was doing some incredible work as a producer. And, you know, the word got out that if you want a great record, you go to David Parker to do your record. If you're in Christian music or worship, and this was even the early beginnings of what we know now as modern worship. And so, Joel Engel was doing stuff. And so through that, you know, word got out, I guess, to Shane Bernard, hey, you know, you use David as a producer. And so through that, you know, they ended up connecting. And man, you talk about, we did so many records in that room, but that is the one record I remember the most, just because it was so unique at the time. The stuff that they were playing on acoustic guitar, and the songs and the vibe, and just the energy of that whole record was just, it is seared in my mind. And I've got great memories of tracking that thing.
In that room at First Euless
is where we made that record.
Okay. Now you're going to tell me other people that y'all worked with early. So
yeah. Billy Foot was one. Billy Foot, if you may not know, is he wrote You Are My King, which is a big Amazing Love, How Can It Be, you know, that big worship song in the late 90s, early 2000s. Did a couple of his records. Joel Engel, I mentioned him a couple of times, done many records. A guy named Ross King, who's a songwriter here in Nashville now, but he used to travel and lead worship. Usually Breakaway at A&M there in College Station. David was, you know, there was not a massive saturation of producers back in the day like there are now. It was a little bit more of a barrier to entry to get into it with the gear and technology, unlike today where, you know, a few hundred dollars can get you in wearing the title of producer. But you know, it wasn't the gear that made David successful. It was his heart and his desire to just pour into great artists and do really great work. And so it's just, man, just those were fun days. You know, you don't know you're in the good old days till you look back and go, those were the good old days.
Now my mind's firing here, and I'm not one to prolong things. I know you probably have things to do, but don't let me forget, because I want to talk about David, where he is right now. But then also, it just flew through my mind, something else you said. It was another great thought, but on David, you know, he resigned from 121 here recently. And, you know, now if I was the Lord and in his life, I'd be saying, David, you need to come to Nashville. But have you talked to him? Does he have any plans? Is he going to stay in Texas, or is he going to come here? Or,
yeah,
he's kind of mobile.
We've you know, moving changed our relationship in not in a bad way, just in a proximity way. And so we, you know, obviously don't talk as much as we can. Karen and I went to his last Sunday at 121. We surprised him and Diana there. I just had to be there. I wanted to honor him, stand with my brother who's been so, you know, he's been there. He's the reason I'm doing what I do ultimately. And so, and through that, we've just kept in touch. I just talked to him last week. I just kept checking in on him and, you know, him and Diana are ministry through and through. That's in their blood. And so I think right now they're just kind of praying through what that looks like. And, you know, I don't think there's any chances of him moving to Nashville. I think, you know, they love it there with their family, but, the Lord's got some great things ahead of him. And I know he's dreaming. David's a dreamer and he's also an executor, but he's a big dreamer. So he's shared with me some things they're dreaming on. And, I think it's just a matter of time.
Well, he's agreed to come on the show. So we're still working out the time. He had a death in the family, so I'm giving him some space, but, people will meet David Parker. So the connection, yeah, with all these cats. Well, then Sean Moffitt, are you connected? I mean, because I know David is, you know, it was either you or David that connected Joseph, I guess, with Sean Moffitt first. But now, did you know Sean from the Texas days, or was that just David?
Yeah, no, David didn't have anything to do with Sean. David doesn't really know Sean.
Okay, so it was you. Okay,
it was me. Yeah. So crazy enough, again, just how the Lord uses things is mind blowing, but. Right as we were doing the Hope of Glory record, which is what you mentioned earlier, with Jesus, I Love You on it. I got a random MySpace message, if that tells you how long ago it was, from Sean Moffitt, this guy named Sean Moffitt. And he was living in Connecticut where he's from, just introducing himself, saw my profile as a producer in Dallas. He's a mix engineer in Connecticut, just was trying to make a connection, you know, and just, hey, if you could ever use my services. And so at the time I was just like, you know, I mixed everything myself but I was like, you know, I'd love to talk and just figure out, you know, if there's ever a project we could work on. So the first thing he ever did, I ended up making it work where he actually mixed Hope of Glory, the record. And, soon after that, he moved to Nashville, which is a crazy story, and to begin with, of just how he moved to Nashville and got connected. And, I started coming out to Nashville for a couple of reasons early on before I moved here to write, but then I would produce records in Dallas and I'd fly out here to mix in with Sean. I just sit in on the mix sessions for, you know, 3 or 4 days with him. Him and Carrie, his wife, were gracious enough to let me stay at their house, and I would just stay there with them, and we'd just spend all day, and I'd sit to his left and I'd just watch him work Pro Tools and mixing, and just a gift. And so he became a big encourager to me and just kind of sounding board of our family moving here and just talking through that, and a massive encourager. And to this day, we still work on records together and talk. And through that, you know, I introduced them to both Colton and Joseph, and yeah, it's just been cool. And I just saw that Colton worked on the Keith Urban thing. I had no idea that was even coming down the pipe, which was awesome.
Well, and so that's what, just as you're watching this, people, that to see this interconnectivity. And so Sean is in Connecticut. Now then Jonathan Mason was on the show, I guess last, I've got another one from another show I've got to finish, you know, editing, but, Jonathan, the first person he met in Nashville was Sean, because Sean was connected with people in his church in, Massachusetts?
Yeah, he's in Massachusetts. Yeah.
And so they said, well, you know, there's a guy that you need to meet down there. And so that's how Jonathan got to Nashville, was through Sean. But then you knew Sean from him reaching out to you through MySpace. That is an amazing story, brother. I tell you how exciting. It gives me hope. It should give everyone hope that, I mean, boy, we need to stay focused and on the small things. I just think, Chris, had you not responded to Sean.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's true.
You know, all those years ago, and he, if you're listening, you need to look him up. I think his name's Sean Moffett. I think. Is it two T's?
Yeah.
But he is one of the, probably, I think, everything I can tell, he's the top final mix engineer. And he's so amazing that I think now people don't even take their music past that to mastering, that he just finishes the album out, which, you know, the final mix engineer is the one who takes you know, the 16,000 tracks that happen digitally now, and he makes them sonically work to where they're vibrant, which is a tremendous challenge. I remember when my youngest son Joseph was taking recording at Dallas Baptist, he went to the same school Chris did, and he's in there working in on his laptop, and he's like, I don't understand what's going on. I was like, you know, walked in on him. I said, what's wrong? And he goes, well, I need more vocal. He says, but I need the horns to come up, but then I'm clipping, which means he's distorting. I don't know. He's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do about this, you know? And then all of a sudden you realize, like Gautier, when he had that song, Somebody I Used to Know, mm-hmm. it sounds real simple, but man, he's got like a couple of hundred tracks going on that makes that simple sound, and the master, you know, that he is in the studio. So that is so cool. Wow. Yeah. MySpace, for those of you who don't know MySpace, it was the original social media. So, but I tell you there, it's, that's profound. I'm telling you that gets me pumped up. So I'm sorry, I got sidetracked because all these things that are popping in my head, but, great. So back on your smoking now, are you, I've seen some stuff. One thing about men who smoke, and I'm talking about who smoke fresh meats,
yeah,
is that you will photograph what you're smoking. So Chris will post things. So how is that going for you?
Yeah, we're proud of what we make. You know, you have to post it. No, yeah, I got the bug a while ago, years ago, and I got the Traeger, and just I found in Nashville, and you may understand this, Kenny. They don't understand good Texas brisket, so you got to make it yourself. You know, so we're in pork country, so you know they got that dialed in. But yeah, it's a stress relief for me. But even I've grown the arsenal. I now have a Blackstone griddle, and so which I'm loving now. I got my boy. It pays to have boys that have jobs. They buy you good stuff for Christmas. So they bought that for Christmas.
So mom's pumping you like, what do you want for Christmas, Chris? And then you tell the kids. And then now, do you have the Blackstone? That have you seen the latest edition? I was in Walmart and they had a Blackstone griddle, which is a big. If you haven't seen it, folks, it's a big, massive. In the Spanish world, they call it a La Plancha. But you can cook everything on there that you don't want to have either a smoke or a charred flavor. It's like having a big Dairy Queen grill, you know, grill. So have you seen or maybe you have it, but they have a new one that has four air fryers underneath.
Yeah. I don't have that one, but I have seen that.
I thought, now this is genius, and it has separate controls. So instead of stinking up, you know, we have a air fryer that we just love, who's it made by? It's a Ninja air fryer, but it's small. And so what's amazing, it uses infrared heat. And because it's like only this tall, I mean, it comes to heat at like, you know, killer temperature and almost instantly, but we use it for everything. So yeah. So the black, and if you haven't seen Blackstone, folks, go online, type in Blackstone. Whoever is behind that company and the marketing and the look, I mean, it's amazing. So So now tell me about that though. So now you've gotten into grilling on the griddle.
Yeah. It's, you know, I joke, the reason they bought it is because they're going to benefit from it. And, so now, you know, I scour YouTube and find all these recipes, and, you know, I have all sorts of links and folders on my browser now. And so they're begging me to make this. And so, you know, it's a learning curve. I'm learning some things on it, but, that's just, it's a side hobby, and it's a little stress relief for me just to get outside and cook something. So
there you go. I tell you, our next door neighbor in Greenwood, Arkansas, James Franks, and, the way our house was situated, we were on a cul-de-sac. And so his yard came all the way to the back. And, you know, cause it kind of bent out, and his, you know, he was in part of the pie. And one day I look out the back, you know, we had a picture window, and it's cold, it's freezing cold. And I see smoke, you know, coming up, and I thought, what in the world's going on? You know, and it was early morning, and there's a guy standing over there, and he's, you know, in sweats and a hoodie, and the hoodie's pulled up and gloves, and he's facing away from me, and he's looking at this, fire that's burning on the ground. It's not even that was before fire pits. And I thought, what is he doing? And he just stood out there, and, you know, for a long time with this little fire back in the corner of the yard, right by my house. And, so later, and I didn't really know him that well at the time, And I said, James, I said, I saw you out back, you know, at the fire pit. Were you burning trash? And he said, no. And I said, well, what were you doing? And he said, well, Kenny, you know, sometimes a man's just got to burn. And I was young. I didn't understand. It's like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
It's in us. So, anyway, that's fascinating. Well, I tell you, Chris, it's been wonderful to have this time with you. I've known you a long time, but like I told you before you came on, but there's things I don't know about you, and it's been very encouraging today. I tell you, I always ask people if they want to share something, you know, to impart to people. And I wanted to share what Chris sent back to me. I said, if there was one piece of advice you could impart to the audience, what would it be? And Chris wrote to me, he said, do great work, serve people, stay humble, and let God lead. And I think Chris's life models that. So, Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I really appreciate it. I love you guys. Love the Price family, and just honored to be a part, Kenny. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. We love you. And I tell you, folks, with that, we bid you peace.